With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us today on the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, why Canada's meat industry is watching the U.S. We'll have more on that. But we start today with Brian German.
We're joined by Aaron Wingate this morning, lead agronomist at Tritech Ag Products and executive board member of the Western Region Certified Crop Advisor Program. And now, Aaron, I understand that Western Region CCA is once again offering some financial support to help bring along the next generation of agronomists through some scholarship opportunities, right?
Yeah. So the Western Region Certified Crop Advisors are offering four $1,000 scholarships to college students in the Western Region. And those four scholarships go into students in the Arizona, California desert area, the coastal region of California, California Northern Valley is the third, and the Southern Valley is the fourth. And in addition to the student scholarships, we also have four $500 honorariums available for professors who are interested or already providing agronomy-related coursework. And those four honorariums go to teachers in the same regions in the Western area.
So both some educators and students have some opportunity there to maybe get some support. And now, what are some of the parameters for these?
For the students, we've got a scholarship application open online, and it asks several questions for the students to answer in paragraph format. And we're asking them to describe the coursework that they're enrolled in and have completed. We'd like to know what year they are in school, their GPA and major. We also want to know a little bit about them other than just their classes. So we want to know if they've gotten any other scholarships or awards or any other special recognition for something that they have done. And we want to know if they're involved in any leadership roles, either at school or within their communities. And we want to know if they've got a history of professional commitment to agriculture already. So have the students done any agriculture-related internships or work over the summers? Are they involved with any agricultural clubs at school, that sort of thing? And then finally, we want to know what their pathway is in the agricultural industry, especially we want to encourage students to become certified crop advisors. So we ask what their plan is for becoming certified crop advisor and when they plan to take our exam. And then for the professors, we ask that they write and submit a plan of how they would like to use the funds if they win the honorarium. So we want to get an idea of the kinds of lesson plans or projects that teachers are putting together to encourage their students to learn and participate in agriculture.
So again, a way to support both the educated and the educators there that are interested in becoming kind of that next generation of agriculturalists. And what is the timeline for this in terms of the application and when some of these awards are announced?
The applications are open online now for students. They can go to www.wrcca.org/scholarships. And for professors, it's www.wrcca.org/honorariums. And the applications are open online until May 10th. And then we will select the winners and present the awards at the annual Progressive Crop Consultant Conference that will be held in Visalia in September.
So just about a little under a month and a half to get those applications sent in. And we'll have a link up at our website, agnetwest.com, for people to find those direct links to apply as well. And Aaron, how many years have you folks been offering these scholarship opportunities?
We've been offering these awards for 4 years now, and so this will be the fifth year that we're doing these scholarships, and it's been an awesome program. I've been a part of reading over the applications, and I've been so impressed with the students and all of the work that they are doing. Really impressive coursework and community work, extracurriculars, all involved in agriculture. And I think that this really provides students with a way to expand their circles into agricultural professional networks. And being able to receive the award at the Progressive Crop Consultant Conference gives them a chance to come and see this big conference, meet lots of people, and we can recognize them and really say, hey, you've done an incredible job at school and you've got a bright future. And same thing for the professors. They work incredibly hard and deserve that recognition. And it is their projects and their enthusiasm that helps bring in the next generation of agriculturalists who are well-rounded and are going to make a big impact on our industry.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
You're listening to the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. In today's National Spotlight, the House Agriculture Committee held a hearing on the danger China poses to American agriculture, and we have team coverage from Eric Pfeiffer and CJ Miller.
There's been a lot of talk about the threat that the Chinese government poses on U.S. agriculture, but one ag leader spoke before Congress this week to share with lawmakers just how serious those threats have become. CJ Miller kicks us off.
Do you believe that food and agriculture sector is adequately prepared for and possesses the ability to respond to a major cyber attack against our key suppliers in the ag industry?
No, we are not.
And that's Kip Thom, Indiana farmer and former U.S. ambassador to the UN Agencies for Food and Agriculture, answering a question from Congressman Brad Finstad during a hearing held Wednesday before the House Ag Committee on Chinese threats to U.S. agriculture. Thom says he's extremely concerned about cybersecurity and that the Chinese government may be looking to hijack our computer systems and hold our data for ransom.
Farming operations could be halted by ransomware attacks, demanding payments to restore access to essential digital systems. And we all can remember the ransom attacks on JBS several years ago, which disrupted the entire supply chain from livestock production operations to the consumer's dinner table. The $11 million ransom was paid, but the cost to JBS and the agricultural supply chain was many multiples greater.
Thom also shared a personal experience about Chinese nationals who were here in the U.S. stealing ag research information and then sending it back to China.
The Chinese have targeted proprietary farming data, such as crop yield data, seeding or fertilizer algorithms, breeding information, and biotechnology research, which will lead to a loss of competitive advantage for the United States. I have seen this firsthand in the seed production industry. Several Chinese nationals were stealing proprietary seeds in our area from production fields and shipping them back to China. These Chinese nationals were caught and convicted, but how many were not caught?
Thom said that the Chinese government is also making every attempt to spy on the USDA as well as our top ag businesses.
The Chinese are creative in their attempts to steal as much information as possible from as many sources possible from the USDA FSA offices to our industries and from any conduit that flows data or conversations.
Eric Pfeiffer has more now on Ambassador Thom's testimony this week before the House Ag Committee.
All right, CJ, thanks. In addition to cyber threats, Thom told lawmakers that China has a stronghold on manufacturing products that are essential to agriculture, with 70% of all crop nutrition products coming from China.
This is a national security threat to the United States and our allies. Imagine if they shut off our supply. Without crop protection products or crop nutrients, yields will decrease, requiring substantially more land to maintain current production levels. The economic impact to farmers, consumers, and our nation would have devastating consequences. This would lead to higher consumer prices and food insecurity in the United States and around the world.
And Thom added that China has been using agriculture to strengthen their control over the U.S. and other countries around the world.
Xi Jinping and the Chinese Communist Party recognize the importance of food in relation to their position of power in the world. The CCP's goal is to reshape the world order through their control of the BRIC nations, global trade, and the Belt and Road Initiative, all to attain economic superiority over the United States and our allies. To meet these goals, they are strategically growing their agriculture production domestically and globally at the expense of the United States.
And Thom pressed lawmakers to do more in response to those threats from China.
The Chinese are strategically attempting to build their dominance in the world over food systems. These moves are coming at the expense of American innovation, but are amplified by our burdensome regulatory environment. the people in these chambers on this Hill need to take action to bring our supply chains home, protect our innovation, and increase our funding for research and development. Now is the time for a national strategy for our agricultural and food systems. If not, America could once again face food insecurity like we did 100 years ago.
I'm Eric Pfeiffer.
That's today's National Spotlight. In livestock news, Canada's meat industry is monitoring V-Cool developments in the U.S. Dennis Guy reports from Canada.
Canada's red meat livestock sector says it will be watching developments closely following the USDA's announcement of new product of U.S. labeling rules coming into effect at the beginning of 2026. Those rules, which say beef and pork products derived from animals that have been inclusively born, raised, slaughtered, and processed, all on American soil, would qualify for new product of USA label standards. Both the Canadian Pork Council and the Canadian Cattle Association say the new inclusive rules will be among the strictest in the world. The Canadian Pork Council and the Canadian Cattle Association say the upcoming labeling rules, which are described as voluntary by the U.S. industry, are far too reminiscent of the mandatory country of origin labeling rules. M-Cool, which was ruled as discriminatory to Canadian and Mexican red meat by the World Trade Organization, was abolished in 2015. Dennis Laycraft, Executive Vice President of the Canadian Cattle Association, says that under its current guidelines, what is widely being called V-Cool will be hard to deal with for industry players on both sides of the U.S. border.
The label is to be voluntary, but it's going to maintain the born, raised, slaughtered, and processed in the U.S. definition. And if it gets broadly adopted and it becomes a condition of trade, that makes it one of the most onerous rules in the world.
The U.S. and Canada have the largest two-way trade with American meat processors, as well as many U.S. cattlemen relying on Canadian cattle. Dennis Laycraft says that when the new rules come into play, they will largely disqualify that trade.
It's a big issue for many feeders in Texas, Kansas, and Nebraska that bring a lot of Canadian feeder animals in. This rule basically disqualifies that trade, which has been pretty important to a number of U.S. producers as well.
The new rules are set to come into effect at the beginning of 2026. Dennis Laycraft says as that date draws closer and the American industry sees what's involved, he believes those new rules will be found to be extremely complicated for American industry partners, for the U.S. meat industry itself, and for both foreign and domestic consumers.
As you go through the rule, there's actually going to be two product of USA definitions. There's one for export that they say each country determines with the U.S., and then there's the product of USA in the United States. That'll become more apparent as the rule gets closer to coming into effect.
Canada and Mexico have retained the WTO's 2015 authorization to retaliate against an origin labeling measure that would unfairly discriminate against imports of live cattle and hogs. Reporting from Canada, I'm Dennis Guy.
Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you just need to catch the news at a different time, you can subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. That's AgNet NewsHour, and it's available on both Apple and Android devices. Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have today's This Land of Ours report, but first, more of the day's agriculture news. And with today's AgNet West headlines, here's AgNet West Farm News Director, Brian German.
Multiple projects are underway to support water flexibility in the Cahuilla Subbasin. General Manager of the Tulare Irrigation District, Aaron Fukuda, described where they're at in the development of the McKay Point Reservoir and another similar effort that's further along in the process.
You got to get it out for public review. That starts the clock. We're hoping, you know, all things go well, we'll begin excavation this year. So again, it's the material will be excavated and then sold into the market. So depending on the market, that could be anywhere between, you know, 10 and 20 years. We do have a neighboring project we're starting to work on right now. We purchased a completed mining operation called the Seaborn site, and we're turning that into a reservoir. So the hole's already there. That will bring about 8,000 acre feet of storage, and we hope to have that done in the next 2 or 3 years.
Purina Animal Nutrition, in partnership with the Land O'Lakes Foundation, has launched a scholarship program for students with agriculture and livestock experience. High school seniors, along with undergraduate students with livestock experience, can apply for one of the four $5,000 scholarships. Applicants should demonstrate academic excellence, leadership, community involvement, and a clear vision for their future in animal agriculture. Scholarship applications will be accepted through April 17th. Awardees will receive their scholarship funds for the fall 2024 semester at their current or anticipated educational institution. The scholarship is open to all high school students intending to enroll in full-time undergraduate study, as well as undergraduate students already enrolled at accredited institutions. Interested applicants can apply online at purinamills.com/scholarship. The U.S. Department of Agriculture is making investments to help support the organic sector. USDA's Agricultural Marketing Service has allocated approximately $40.5 million to fund 60 grant projects through the Organic Market Development Grant Program. These projects aim to bolster both new and existing organic markets, enhance processing capacity, explore emerging technologies, and procure equipment to meet rising demand for organic commodities. The program is anticipated to benefit over 27,000 producers and nearly 32 million consumers. Priority consideration was given to projects addressing specific market needs such as organic grains, livestock feed, dairy, fibers, legumes, and rotational crops. This grant program is part of the USDA Organic Transition Initiative launched in fall of 2022, offering support to existing and transitioning organic farmers. The Natural Resources Conservation Service works with a variety of partners to help ranchers with livestock pond restoration efforts. Biologist with Alameda County Conservation District, Farley Connolly, explained the quality of habitat provided by the ponds and the conservation value they offer.
And it's when you walk to one of these ponds, you see it and it looks like a cattle pond. It's muddy, you can see the hoof prints, and then you start to examine it closer and it's just full of critters. These ranchers are really protecting what is kind of the last bastion of good habitat for a lot of these species. You have these amazing populations of regular frogs or California tiger salamanders, newts, other types of species of frog, other toads. Provides habitat for birds and other wildlife that need water resources. And now we're really seeing, hey, turtles are also in these ponds. We know we've known that for a long time, but now we're realizing more and more that these things are really just on the last stand, in a sense, for turtles across what is a decreasing habitat for them.
The Lockford Plant Materials Center will be holding their Spring Field Day on Wednesday, April 3rd. As usual, the field day will focus on cool season cover crops, and this year the focus is on aspects of cover crop seeding. The event will begin at 9:30 in the morning with a drone seeding demonstration. Manager of the Lockford Plant Materials Center, Margaret Smither-Caperl, will be presenting information on conservation cover for orchards and vineyards, as well as a seeding rate planting date study. There will also be a cover crop demonstration and no-till planting comparison, and a planting demonstration of a roller crimper. UC Cooperative Extension Agronomy Farm Advisor Sarah Light will also be presenting information on equipment considerations for cover cropping. More information on the field day is available on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for Agnet West Radio Network.
What do you think of current food prices? A new study looks at what people around the nation are thinking. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. While inflation has eased somewhat, food prices are still high. A study conducted by the University of Illinois and Purdue University asked consumers what types of companies they believe are behind the high food prices. Purdue economist and co-author of the study, Brenna Ellison, says consumers are frustrated with many downstream actors, like food manufacturers, grocery stores, and restaurants, feeling these groups are overcharging them. Two-thirds of consumers consider food manufacturers too big, and more than half of those surveyed believed grocery stores have too much control or market share. The survey showed consumers felt farmers were the least to blame. Despite political differences, a significant number of consumers across party lines shared concerns about the size of food manufacturers and grocery stores, indicating a bipartisan worry regarding market power, despite often significant political differences in the respondents. The Agriculture Secretary reveals how consumers surveyed shaped development of a voluntary label for meat, poultry, and egg products produced, processed, and packaged in our nation. Rudd Bain reports.
Consumers, here's an example of how your input shaped a voluntary labeling option for meat, poultry, and egg products.
We surveyed consumers. We asked them the question, when you see this label, what do you think it means?
So Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack, what did most consumers surveyed think was the meaning behind the Product of USA label.
It means everything was done in the United States.
From birth to slaughter, processing and packaging, all located in our country. Yet Secretary Vilsack pointed out,
well, actually, that's not been the case.
As the prior version of the Product of USA label allowed designation of that label on meats, poultry, and eggs processed in the U.S. In other words, origin of an animal and the raising and slaughter of such could occur outside our country as long as the product was processed in our nation. The secretary acknowledged the consumer confusion caused by the previous Product of USA definition, leading to a review of that label and its claims starting 3 years ago.
Take a look at trying to create some consistency and transparency and predictability in terms of labeling. We had a proposed rule, Product of the USA. We received 3,300 comments about that rule,
which culminated in USDA's announcement this month regarding the voluntary Product of USA label.
We are now on record as being for the utilization of that label only when the animal is born, raised, slaughtered, and processed in the U.S.
In addition,
we were also basically saying you can't get by with slapping an American flag on the package unless the animal is born, raised, slaughtered, and processed in the U.S.
Remember earlier when it was mentioned consumer input was part of the rule development process? The agriculture secretary said one question asked surveyed individuals pertained to the value of the Product of USA label to them when they shop for meats, poultry, and eggs.
Do you place a value on that? I mean, in other words, are you willing to pay a nickel or two more if that is on the list? Well, absolutely. We want to help our farmers.
Based on that input, Secretary Vilsack believes,
in order for that value proposition to be respected, in order for there to be fairness and honesty and proper representation in the marketplace, it's important to have rules like this.
Establishments wishing to voluntarily use the Product of USA label will now find updated guidance that shows the types of documentation needed to support label use, as well as examples of claims used for such labeling. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
For more national news now, we go to Cindy Zimmerman.
I'm here at the Ace Fly-In, and I'm with Bill Kauser, my friend from Iowa, who's a cattle producer and an ethanol plant investor, and also a member of the EPA Farm, Ranch, and Rural Communities Advisory Committee, and something he's been on before and been on for a while. So, Bill, tell us about that committee and your involvement in it.
Yeah, they reenacted it about 6 years ago, and they put out to the United States, they wanted people to put in their application and kind of a broad base across the country of livestock producers and different academia. And out of 560 applications, I was very blessed to be one of the 30 to become on and be able to represent the farming community, the ethanol community, agriculture, basically. And what our job is to do is we basically get three or four challenges every year from the administrator. And our job is to come together with a white paper. It's how can EPA improve their methods of reaching out to rural America, to the cities of America, whether it's wastewater, whether it's manure issues, whether it's methane, and how do we make sure that the administration hears from grassroots?
Mm-hmm. Well, you've worked with several different EPA administrators. What do you think about our current administrator?
Well, as I stated in the meeting here, we had the privilege of hosting Regan and Vilsack the first week on the job here 3.5 years ago in our shop. And like I stated, it's the first time I've seen in my career of 30 or 40 years coming in here of those two gentlemen from different offices in the same room at the same time, because we would always get their staff. And to see the relationship now that EPA and USDA have and can sit down together, not their staff, but the two leaders, and come to an agreement where everybody can work through some of the issues and policies that we've got going on. And then to be part of the farming community or the agriculture community and bring a recommendation to both of those gentlemen, because, you know, I know them both personally. It means something, and they've always got someone they can call.
Well, you also spend a lot of time here up in D.C. You're here for the ACE-DC fly-in. You're here almost every year, as far as I know. And you also come up here with other groups. So just tell me about your experience this year and some of the meetings that you had and how they went.
Well, you know, I can honestly say I've been doing this for 30 years. And in the last 10 years, we finally have a seat at the table. You know, as a livestock producer, when I put on my cattle cap, you know, the EPA was a bad word. I mean, we would never let them in. And another gentleman, Dave Petty from Iowa, and I decided 20 years ago we were going to change that relationship. So now we've cultivated it to where we have those positions. I have three appointments in EPA now, and we've actually held meetings in the National Cattlemen's Office with EPA, which you would have never heard of 10 years ago. So we feel very strongly that we've cultivated a relationship because they're part of our team now, and we can't forget that. Whether you're ethanol, whether you're agriculture, whatever it is, they're part of your team because it's part of the policy, it's part of the rulemaking. And as a feedlot operator, I have an NPDES permit, so I have rules and regulations I have to follow. And the reason I'm so adamant, I think I'm in here every month for the next 7 months to do something with EPA or USDA, is I want to make sure that my sons, or our sons and daughters, can farm in the future with policy they can survive with.
Well, as far as the issues facing the ethanol industry right now, year-round E15, getting the GREET model right for SAF, those kinds of things, that's what we talked about on the Hill this week. What do you think the chances are that any of that is going to get done in this presidential election year?
Well, I don't know if we'll see it done in this presidential election year. I think everyone, when you go to the Hill, it's a different mindset today. And it's challenging, but we heard positive messages from the D's and from both sides of the aisle. And they all want to get it done. They want to get a farm bill done. They want to get E15. But it's going a little bit slower, I think, on the EPA side because they want to make sure that this is done right and they get sued less. You know, I think that's one of the challenges because everybody's not afraid to sue today. And so if it does take us another year, it might have to be. But we're going to continue to say, let's get it signed because we got to do it eventually. We've smoothed all the rough edges over for whether, you know, on our Hill visits, whether Democrat or Republican. Everybody's in agreement because if you're involved in climate or believe in climate, we're part of the solution. And that's what this administration is driven for. So the big man says, we're doing this. Let's get it done. And I think that's the other thing. I think it's something we need to understand. We will always respect the office of the president, no matter who, because it's our job to decide who's there. And who's ever there, that's fine. But we've learned over the years, we're going to put ourselves close to the career people because they're going to be here the next time I come to D.C.
That's a very good point. That's all the questions I have, Bill. Anything else you want to add?
Well, I just want to thank agriculture for allowing us to be in here. And I want to make sure that everyone, you know, you have the opportunity to come in here and hear your voice.
All right. Thanks very much. Bill Kauser here in Washington, D.C. with the Ace Fly-In. I'm Cindy Zimmerman.
This is the AgNet NewsHour, and we will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour. Brian German has today's featured interview.
We're joined by Jackie Charbonneau, ecologist with USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service, and Farley Connolly, biologist with Alameda County Conservation District. And today we're talking about some ongoing conservation work you're doing in the area that encompasses several different projects and approaches. But first, let's start out here with some of the pond restoration work that's been taking place for quite a while now.
We've been working on livestock pond restoration for, I think it's been about 20 years now. And that kind of stemmed from our stakeholders, the ranchers coming to us and saying, help, we need help restoring our ponds, cleaning them out, cleaning sediment out, repairing the embankments and the spillways, because there's a lot of regulatory oversight and work that they used to do just on their own now, because we're in such an urban rural area, has so much oversight that everyone said, we need permits for this. We need help. So we started doing pond restoration, kind of being that in between with the regulatory agencies and the ranchers to help get the permitting done. And then it evolved into definitely the technical assistance aspect of it too, with engineering and biology assistance. And really the program's evolved over time. And the primary kind of request was from the ranchers, and then from an NRCS and RCD standpoint, it was important because not only for livestock water, but the ponds were habitat for tons of wildlife. Our focus has primarily been on restoring habitat for California red-legged frog and the California tiger salamander, both two federally listed species. These livestock ponds on the landscape, we think there's probably over 1,000 in Alameda County that were built in the 50s and 60s by cattle ranchers, primarily for livestock water. Now they're really amazing replacement habitat for vernal pools that no longer exist in the valley floor, our creeks are pretty altered from a lot of runoff, so the flows are faster and not necessarily the best breeding habitat for amphibians and reptiles. So we have these ponds. We figured out they're really amazing habitat, and not only for the frog and salamander, but also a lot of them are habitat for western pond turtle. So western pond turtle is now a candidate species under U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. It may get listed as threatened this year, is what they're considering. And our efforts have been working with other partners to really think about what can we do for this turtle, and how can we integrate turtle conservation and work for the turtle with our existing livestock pond program.
I think one thing we really emphasize too is just the quality of habitat these ponds provide. And it's when you walk to one of these ponds, you see it and it looks like a cattle pond. It looks like muddy. It looks like you can see the hoof prints. And then you start to examine it closer and it's just full of critters. And so I think that one of those things that, well, my experience with this, I've been here for about a year and a half, has been just realizing that, you know, these ranchers are really protecting what is kind of the last bastion of good habitat for a lot of these species. And so while these, they look so nondescript, they look like all that could be living there is cow poop and maybe some insects, but in reality, you have these amazing populations of regular frogs or California tiger salamanders, newts, other types of species of frog, other toads, provides habitat for birds and other wildlife that need water resources. And now we're really seeing, hey, turtles are also in these ponds. And we know, we've known that for a long time, but now we're realizing more and more that these things are really just kind of the last stand, in a sense, for turtles across what is a decreasing habitat for them.
And not only the ponds themselves, but the surrounding rangelands. Mm-hmm. The turtles breed in the rangelands surrounding the ponds, and they're just really, really important habitat for the species.
And so these livestock ponds are serving a pretty important role in conserving habitat for a variety of species, western pond turtle being one of those, which is one of the reasons I understand you're taking a closer look at these habitats on rangelands. And so what's that process consist of, and what are some of the long-term goals of the project?
Yeah, so right now, we started up last year, so it's a fairly new study. We have some great partners in East Regional Parks, U.S. Fish and Wildlife. I can keep listing. It's now approximately 8 different contributors. But what we're doing is we're really trying to figure out what is the status of these species. We're focusing on ponds within active rangelands. So that's a really important part of this. We want to really show that rangelands are important habitat. And we're seeing that. We're catching 60 to 100 turtles in these ponds.
On working cattle ranches.
On working cattle ranches. This is not one or two turtles. This is 60 to 100. And we're not catching all of them. You can say we're catching a much smaller percent than that. So these ponds are really vital. So what we're doing is we are doing a population census survey. So we're capturing them, we're tagging them, we're monitoring them in that sense. But we're also putting, which is really exciting, GPS units on them. And these GPS units have solar, 5G, it's state-of-the-art everything. You're able to detect where these turtles are going on your phone. And so the idea is what we're trying to find out is what habitat beyond just the pond are these turtles utilizing? And so we want to know, are they traveling to breed with females, the males? Are the females, how far are they traveling from the pond to go nest? So then using that, we can determine, okay, this upland habitat, maybe they prefer chaparral or grassland or streamways. We're really trying to figure out exactly beyond the pond, what are their other needs? And so using GPS units, we're going to be able to hopefully determine a lot of that.
So quite a bit to be gleaned from this project. And from getting this information, the goal then is to provide feedback to farmers and ranchers on maybe how to help better support these turtles while also helping support their own operation in the process?
Yeah, exactly. So it's, you know, understanding where the turtles are going will allow us to provide that information to ranchers. So whether it is helping them, these are just all theoretical things they could do, but the idea of them maybe changing their grazing schedule on that property. Maybe they, you know, turtles nest out of the water between, say, 10 meters and potentially up to a mile away. And so the idea is we want to kind of locate that area, and we may be able to then control, okay, cattle walking over that. Is that a detriment? Is it not? Can we protect the turtles that way? And we'll still, you know, providing good feed for the cows. So it's really trying to establish for them, like, what needs are the turtles have, and how can we then work with you to make sure the turtles are happy, but also the cows are happy? Because if this species is listed and they put some really strict regulations on it, we don't want that to happen. We think the turtles and the cows are living in symbiosis right now. They have a very nice relationship where some of these habitats are really good for turtles, and they're being grazed, and they're being, you know, live ponds are being used. So the idea is to make sure we know, like, hey, this system works. You know, we can maybe alter it slightly, but we don't want to just say the cows cannot feed around these ponds within a mile. It's like, that's not what we're going for. We're going for let's prove the system works, pretty much, is what we're kind of looking for. Because it seems to be working, and so we want to really show, like, hey, this system works. We don't need these massive restrictions. We want to make sure the turtles are looked after, but also we don't want these ranchers who have been really, I don't know, knowingly or unknowingly, but they've been protecting this species more than a lot of other people have, a lot more than conservationists have, because this is an unlisted species. We want to make sure they're not the ones that suffer in order to protect this turtle. We want to make sure it's mutually beneficial for both the animal, but also the rancher.
And the ranchers have been, like Farley said, I mean, they're the ones that created these ponds. They're the ones that are restoring these ponds. We work with a lot of ranchers that are going through our EQIP program and other grant funding through the RCD to actively do pond restoration for, again, for livestock water, but also for these, for wildlife species.
And they're supporting this work too. This is not, we're not just doing this blindly and the ranchers will be like, oh, wait, what's happening? They're in full support. They want us to do this work. They're really interested too. I mean, they have, you talk to rancher, I have not met one that says they don't like turtles. So they want to also protect these species. And yeah, so they really love the species. They like seeing the frogs. They like seeing, you know, newts. They like seeing all these things. And so it really is kind of, they're supportive of this as well as, you know, they want this species to be conserved. No one wants to see the species disappear. And so working with them, we're going to be able to hopefully, you know, again, provide that like really good information that benefits all of us. We want everybody to be going forward while the species is being listed. We want this to work for everybody.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
You're listening to the AgNet News Hour now for more news. USDA recently announced its first set of awards under its local meat capacity grant program with focus on simplified equipment investments within processing facilities. Rod Bain reports.
Efforts continue to expand meat processing capacity in our country and in turn improve supply chain resilience. The latest example of such was provided by Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack at a recent visit with National Farmers Union members.
42 additional grants under our MCAP program.
That acronym representing USDA's Local Meat Capacity Grant Program.
The purpose of this program is to not only expand and diversify meat and poultry processing that are producer-owned, but to create jobs in rural places, to create consumer choice, and also to increase competition and greater resiliency.
MCAP focuses on two aspects: expansion of equipment and of processing capacity.
We have as priorities within this structure looking at ways in which cooperatives owned by producers can be beneficiaries of this program. We received 709 applications for the nearly $64 million that was available, 539 applications for equipment expansion, and 170 applications for expanded facilities.
This first set of grant awards covers a specific target of simplified equipment investments only.
We make these 42 equipment grants in 27 states in Puerto Rico.
With the total grant amount for this first round of awards at $9.5 million. As far as what investments might look like on the ground level, Secretary Vilsack provided an example from among the projects awarded MCAP funding.
Nordic Meat in Wisconsin, it's going to use its grant to essentially expand its capacity to grind and create ground beef products and to package same for local markets. It will increase, 100% increase in the livestock it can process over the next 2 years. It'll create new jobs in the community and will help 350 small, mid-sized farming operations have a specific market for whatever it is that they're growing and raising.
With this first set of MCAP awards now announced,
we're looking forward to continuing making announcements over the course of the next several months under this program.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
The Agriculture Secretary says USDA will need a little bigger budget next year. Gary Crawford has more.
We have four basic tools in doing the job that you all have outlined to us.
Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack telling the House Ag Appropriations Subcommittee hearing Thursday that those tools include the Farm Bill, the use of Commodity Credit Corporation funding, the conservation resources in the Inflation Reduction Act,
and of course the budget that allows us to fund not only programs, but as importantly, the people that administer the programs, the facilities necessary to administer the programs, and the IT necessary to do a job efficiently.
To that end, Vilsack said for the upcoming 2025 fiscal year that starts October 1st, the administration's asking Congress for a USDA budget of $24.5 billion, $2.3 billion more than the current year, or about an 11% increase. Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
That's today's top agriculture news. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Brian German and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet NewsHour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.